With Passport and Parasol, seven true stories of travel and adventure, written and compiled by Julia Kay.
What had I dared to dream? Into what adventure was I about to throw myself? I remembered previous journeys in Tibet, hardships endured, dangers that I had confronted. It was that again, or even worse, which lay before me. And what would be the end? Would I triumph, reach Lhasa, laughing at those who would close the roads of Tibet? Would I be stopped on my way? Would I fail, this time forever? Meeting death at the bottom of a precipice, hit by the bullet of a robber, or dying miserably of fever beneath a tree or in a cave like some wild beast? Who knew?
An unforgettable vision, the story of Alexandra David Neal, with Dorothy Chutin as Alexandra and Daniel Massey as the narrator.
Western travelers had for years been drawn to Lhasa, the fabled capital of Tibet, the sacred city. Many, indeed most, had failed to reach it. By the early 1920s, only a handful of individual travelers had succeeded. But Lhasa, so steeped in legend, so high and so utterly remote, was still, to all intents and purposes, the forbidden city. And as such, it still held an awesome fascination for explorers, missionaries, and adventurers from the West.
No, no. Strange as the fact may be, I must confess that I never entertained a strong desire to visit the sacred city. What decided me to go to Lhasa in 1923, when I was in my mid-50s, was above all the absurd prohibition which closes Tibet. 18 months before, when I'd been involved in botanical research in the eastern part of Tibet, my trip was brought to an end and I was turned back by border guards. It was then that the idea of visiting Lhasa really became implanted in my mind. Before the frontier post to which I had been escorted, I took an oath that in spite of all the obstacles, I would reach Lhasa and show what the will of a woman could achieve. If heaven is the Lord's, the earth is the inheritance of man, and any honest traveller has the right to walk as he chooses all over that globe which is his. I wanted to pull down the antiquated barriers which surround such a vast area of Asia.
The fact that, although several had tried, no Western woman had yet reached Lhasa was an added spur, and she knew very well that she was better qualified than any other European woman to achieve her goal. Despite her English-sounding name, Alexandra David Neal was the only child of a middle-class French mother and a Belgian father. Her first experience of the East had been a tour of French Indochina as première chanteuse with a Parisian opera company. At the age of 20, however, she had abandoned her musical career to concentrate on the study of comparative religions in general and Buddhism in particular.
Ever since I was a small child in Paris, I had dreamt of setting out for the unknown, or reaching some solitary spot where I could sit alone with no one else near me. As a girl, I dreamed of wild hills, immense deserted steppes, and impassable landscapes of glaciers. When grown up, my love of Oriental philosophy won me a position as a writer and lecturer in a Belgian university. At the end of 1910, I was commissioned by the French Ministry of Education to undertake some Oriental researches. At that time, the ruler of Tibet, the Dalai Lama, had fled from his capital city of Lhasa because of political troubles with China and had taken refuge in a Himalayan village in British Bhutan. Tibet was not altogether unfamiliar to me. I had studied Sanskrit and Tibetan literature at the Sorbonne. Naturally, I wanted to see the Tibetan Pope King and his court.
Now, there's a glaring omission here. No mention of Alexandra's marriage. In 1904, when she was 36 years old, she had met and very soon afterwards married a distant cousin, Philippe Neal, who was chief engineer of Tunis Railways. It had taken her only a few days to decide that marriage was definitely not for her, and the two had, apparently amicably, gone their separate ways. Despite the fact that Philippe would remain her loyal correspondent, friend, and advisor for the next 40 years, financing her travels and acting as her literary agent, Alexandra never mentioned him in any of her books. It was almost as if she was afraid to admit his existence, for fear of undermining her own and the world's faith in her self-reliance. She had left Paris for India in 1911, expecting her visit to last at the most for a few months. It lasted for 14 years. The interview she obtained with the Dalai Lama in Bhutan was momentous in that she was the first Western woman ever to be granted a private audience with the God King. But it had an even more profound effect on her own life.
I found a strange royal household of clerical personages clad in shining yellow satin, dark red cloth, and gold brocade, who related fantastic stories and spoke of a wonderland. When listening to them, I made allowance for legend and exaggeration, but I instinctively felt that behind those dark wooded hills which I saw before me, and the huge snowy peaks beyond, there was truly a land different from all others. What an unforgettable vision! At last I found the calm solitudes of which I had dreamed since my infancy. At last I could see my home.
The Dalai Lama was obviously impressed with Alexandra's knowledge and understanding of Buddhist doctrine, rare in any Westerner, unique in a Western woman, and suggested that she should learn the Tibetan language. She had needed no further prompting. 12 years later, in 1923, as she at last turned her face towards Lhasa itself, she spoke Tibetan as fluently as a native. She had spent the intervening 11 years living and travelling in Sikkim, Nepal, China, Mongolia, and the mountainous fringes of Tibet. She was a practising Buddhist, had spent a year living as a hermit in a cave 13,000 feet up in the Himalayas, and 3 years studying and meditating in a remote monastery. In every respect, she had become as Tibetan as any Tibetan, and the monks had conferred on her the title of Honorary Lama in recognition of the depth of her knowledge of the philosophy, literature, and ancient scriptures of Tibetan Buddhism. Yet there was one barrier in this process of metamorphosis that she was unable to cross. She still looked like a European. In Sikkim and Nepal, no one had objected to the presence of a European. In the remote mountain fastness of the Kumbum Monastery in northern Tibet, there had been no officials to notice. But it would be quite a different matter on the high road to Lhasa.
But previous experience had proved to me that I could escape notice in the disguise of a poor traveller. Most of my fellow travellers would probably be pilgrims from various regions of Tibet, and my best plan was to merge into their number like a common Ajopa. The Ajopas are those mendicant pilgrims who all through the year ramble in their thousands across Tibet, going from one to another of its sacred places. The Ajopa, not necessarily, but for the most part, belongs to the religious order, either as a monk or a nun. Yungden, who is an authentic and well-read lama, looked his part perfectly, and I would travel as his aged mother, undertaking a long pilgrimage for devotional reasons, thus constituting a touching and sympathetic figure.
Yungden, her young Sikkimese travelling companion, had in fact been in Alexandra's employ for 10 years. But he was no ordinary servant. He had entered a monastery at the age of 8, and was now, at the age of 24, an intelligent, literate lama with a passion for travel and adventure. So well suited were they that eventually, and despite her husband Philippe's vigorous objections, Alexandra would adopt him as her legal son. As a Sikkimese, Yungden would have no trouble in passing for a Tibetan. Not so Alexandra.
Therefore, I lengthened my hair with jet black yak's hair, bound it into long plaits, and in order to match that colour, I rubbed a wet stick of Chinese ink into my own brown hair. I hung large earrings on my ears, and they altered my appearance, and I powdered my face with a mixture of cocoa and crushed charcoal to obtain a dark complexion. The makeup was rather strange, but suppliers to the theatrical trade from whom I could have obtained better ingredients have not yet opened branches in the Tibetan wilds. The headgear caused me some little annoyance, as I could not find a suitable hat in any of the villages we passed. For the time being, an old red belt would suffice, twisted round my head. Yung Den wore his lama's robes, and thus prepared, we gathered our baggage and emerged from the forest, fully fledged Tibetan wayfarers.
The starting point of her journey to Lhasa was a small town on the Yangtze River in the Yunnan province of southern China. Her route would take her in a northwesterly direction round the top of Burma, across the Mekong and Salween rivers, and then due west to Lhasa. As the crow flies, it was a distance of some 700 miles. As the pilgrim walks, however, it would be more than 1,000 miles over the most formidable terrain on earth. Their path would twist and climb over passes more than 18,000 feet above sea level. It would plummet into abysmal valleys, lose itself on grey, gale-swept glaciers, and meander across deserts peopled only by marauding bands of robbers.
We started late, and our first stage was short. We encamped on a small and sheltered tableland which gave us a beautiful view of the highest peak of the Kakapo Range. Towering in a clear sky, lit by a full moon, the peak did not appear to me as the menacing guardian of an impassable frontier. It looked more like a worshipful but affable deity, standing at the threshold of a mystic land, ready to welcome and protect the adventurous lover of Tibet. I built a fire, Yungden brought water from the stream, and we prepared Tibetan tea with butter and salt. Then we examined our baggage, which was still too heavy. We gave up the waterproof ground sheet. We also discarded the only pieces of spare clothing we kept. Nothing was now left us except the clothes we were wearing. Our canteen consisted of one aluminium pot, which was kettle, teapot, and saucepan, all in one. There was one wooden lama bowl for Yung Den, an aluminium one for me, and a Chinese travelling case containing one long knife and chopsticks which could be hung from the belt. That was all. Pilgrims travelling on foot, as we pretended to be, have no more.
As they approached the Chinese-Tibetan border, Alexandra and Yung Den left the main pilgrim road and took to small hill paths. For 2 weeks they travelled only at night, skirting villages and often losing their way in the darkness. By day they sheltered in caves or hid in the forest. Officials, both Chinese and Tibetan, would have a wary eye out for any suspicious characters approaching or attempting to cross that border. The merest hint that the young lama and his elderly mother were anything other than genuine pilgrims would result in their immediate arrest.
The use of our tent would have instantly marked us out as objects of curiosity, so we dared not pitch it. But it was precious as a blanket. We would lie down in some convenient ditch or hollow with our luggage between us so that nothing could be taken without awakening us. The tent was then spread over the luggage and ourselves as well. When snow had fallen, that white tent spread on the ground with a few dry leaves and twigs strewn on it looked, we hoped, like a patch of snow amongst other patches.
The teachings of Alexandra's adopted religion seem to have deserted her under the strain of these early days on the road. Far from resigning herself to whatever fate had in store, she lived in a constant state of near paranoia. She forced poor Yung Den to march sometimes for 18 hours on end, refusing to let him light fires for his beloved tea, and driving both him and herself to the edge of starvation and exhaustion in her determination to cross the frontier undetected.
A few days before reaching the pass, our nerves received an awful shock. We met a soldier coming hurriedly down the path towards us with news that an official from Lhasa was taking a shortcut across the range which we had just begun to mount. We were terrified. No escape was possible. The path lay along a steep slope that did not offer any hiding place. We looked desperately around in the hope that, as in the old tales, a rock or tree would suddenly open and shelter us till the danger was over. Alas, no miracle happened. We heard the jingling of bells, and just above our heads on the winding path appeared a well-dressed man, followed by soldiers and servants leading horses. He stopped at the sight of us. According to Tibetan custom, we threw ourselves hurriedly on the low side of the road to show our respect. Now began the questions about our mother country, about our journey and other things. When all had been said, the official remained looking silently at us. I felt as if needles were piercing my brain. Did these men doubt us? That silence must be broken. With the chanting tone of the Tibetan beggars, I implored charity. Noble sir, give us alms, please. At the sound of my voice, the official and his party relaxed. He took a coin from his purse and with a smile to me, handed it to Yung Den. I answered the favor with the most respectful of Tibetan salutes. I put out my tongue as far as I could extend it, and the official party went on their way.
It was not very long before they fell in with a group of pilgrims, and had at last to begin the apprenticeship of the career they had embraced. Of course, the fact that Yung Den was a genuine lama made the business of begging food and shelter very much easier. The villagers knew that they would gain spiritual merit by giving alms to a holy man. And the sight of the lama striding round the corner brought the inhabitants scuttling out of their homes. In a trice, Yung Den would be surrounded by supplicants begging him to reveal to them the whereabouts of a lost cow or to recite prayers for the soul of a recently deceased relative. Few of these villagers paid any attention to the little brown-robed lady, leaning on her pilgrim staff, eyes cast humbly to the ground, who followed in his wake. Yung Den would intone the appropriate prayers or cast stones into the air to study the pattern of their fall. Well, Alexandra, meanwhile, would quietly set about gathering fuel for their fire and water for the tea, secure in the knowledge that Yung Den's eloquence would earn them a handful of barley flour or a few dried-up apricots for their meal.
Yung Den is really gifted for such ritualistic work, and had he continued his life in a lamasery, he might have become quite famous as an oracle or exorcist. But in one village, my attempts to avoid any suspicion about my own identity foundered. We had halted by a small stream that ran just by the village, and a crowd of people had gathered round the lama to listen to him telling fortunes and the like. Thinking it prudent to accentuate my respect and to serve Yung Den in all ways, I humbly spread an old sack for him to sit on and then took the empty kettle and proceeded to wash it in the stream. But the contact of the water with my hands had the natural result of cleaning them, and with that beginning of cleanliness appeared the whiteness of my skin. In my preoccupation with my lowly role, I had not noticed this, but then I heard a woman in a low voice say to another, "Her hands are like those of a foreigner." I did not show in any way that I had heard the remark, and quickly rubbed my hands on the bottom of the greasy utensil. Yung Den appeared not to have heard either, but by a wonderful stroke of good fortune, at that moment, a villager ventured to ask him where he was going. He told them that we had made a pilgrimage to the holy mountain of Karkapo and were now going back to our own country. The strain relaxed. The idea of foreigners going on a pilgrimage seemed extremely funny, and they all laughed. "They are Mongolians," said one, and this was what the whole village believed when we left. Much of the region we now entered was still terra incognita to geographers, and I could not but deeply regret that the odd disguise I had assumed prevented me from gathering the few observations that my modest ability would have allowed me to make. I knew from experience that to carry instruments and requisites for plain scientific work would lead to my detection. In the event, even the sketch maps with which I had been provided by kind friends with a little first-hand or hearsay knowledge of the region were of little use to me. As with all maps of Tibet, the name written on them in no way corresponded to those we heard from the native. The rivers and mountains were not in the places they were shown to be, and a number of them were completely ignored, as were also the roads.
The best she could do in the way of dates was to mention that they started out in the autumn and travelled through the winter. The altitude of the Tibetan plateau and its position in the centre of a vast continent mean that the air is dry. Snowfall is restricted to the higher ranges, leaving the valley clear and passable throughout all but the severest winters. But the cold is intense. Bitter winds blowing down from the icy tops penetrate even the thickest of sheltering forests, and severe night frosts freeze the lakes and rivers. Alexandra and Yung Den would have to cross several of these higher ranges on their way to Lhasa. This would mean days at a time with no forests for shelter, no villages for hospitality, and precious little fuel to make a fire.
True pilgrims sleep in the open only when they cannot avoid it. As a rule, they halt near some building, and when happy enough to be called inside, they never think of refusing the good luck. I knew I could not expect much attention on such occasions, but only the condescending kindness of the coarse and common folk who would include me in Jungden's train. I was expected to sit on the rough floor of the kitchen, which was dirty with the grease of the soup, the butter of the teas, and the spit of the inmates. Well-meaning women offered me scraps of meat which they had cut on the laps of their dress, which had been used maybe for years as a handkerchief or a kitchen towel. I had to eat in the way of the poor, dipping my unwashed fingers in the soup and the tea. Yet I knew that such penance would not be without reward. I was living near the very soul and heart of those women folk whom no outsider had ever encountered.
As they approached the most forbidding of the ranges that lay across their path, Alexandra realized that it was now December. They had thus been on the road for more than 2 months. Although she still lived in daily expectation of being unmasked, Alexandra could not help being proud of the expertise with which she was handling her role. She could wail pitifully as the most destitute of beggars, she could pray as long and loud as the holiest of pilgrims, and she could scratch, spit, curse, and blow her nose on her fingers as vigorously as any Tibetan peasant. Most satisfactory of all, she had learned to live and even thrive on the most frugal of diets.
Foreseeing greater hardships than ever on the desert road of the high passes, we decided that day that a specially good meal was required. First soup, then tea. As a rule, we only have one or the other. The recipe for the soup is simple enough. From a bag of the most orthodox local fashion, that is to say, greasy and black with dirt, I take out a small piece of dry bacon, the gift from a kind-hearted householder. Jungden cuts it into a dozen tiny bits, which he throws into a pot of boiling water. Then a pinch of salt and a sigh. Ah, if only we had a radish or a turnip. But we lack these delicacies, and the minute slices of bacon dance alone a lively jig in the boiling broth, a murky liquid, the smell of which reminds me of dishwater. Nevertheless, that smell is not unpleasant to the needy vagrants which we have become. Pure air and long tramps are the best appetizers, and we've eaten nothing since a similar soup with a turnip, but without the bacon, 24 hours before. We followed this broth with a hot cup of tea. Then, feeling perfectly refreshed, we looked boldly to the first range silhouetted against the horizon and felt capable of climbing to the sky. How happy I was to be there, en route for the mystery of those unexplored heights, alone in the great silence, tasting the sweets of solitude and tranquility.
In an exuberant moment, Alexandra had decided to experiment with an untried route over the range. To be the first European woman to reach Lhasa was her first and main ambition. The possibility of becoming, in the process, the first European of any description to travel there via a new and unmapped pass was a temptation she could not resist. Knowing that it would have been out of character for pilgrims to display curiosity about what lay ahead, they had made only the vaguest inquiries about their intended route. There had been talk of a hamlet, of yak herds, and even a notable shrine in the valley on the far side, and that had been enough. But now, as they struggled upwards, Alexandra found herself wishing she had heeded Jungden's warnings. The horizon seemed to stay as remote however far they climbed, and with every added meter of altitude, the air grew colder and the icy wind more penetrating.
At last we reached the point from which we had supposed that we would descend the opposite side of the mountain. How could I express what we felt at that moment? It was a mixture of admiration and grief. We were at the same time wonder-stricken and terrified. Think of an immensity of snow, an undulating tableland, limited far away at our left by a straight wall of blue-green glaciers and peaks wrapped in everlasting whiteness. At our right, extended a wide valley which ascended to the neighboring summits on the skyline. In front, a similar but wider stretch of gradually sloping ground vanished in the distance, without our being able to discern whether it led to another pass or another tableland. Yongden and I looked at each other in silence. No talk was needed. We clearly understood the situation. Which was the way? We did not know. The snow did not allow us to see any trace of a trail. It was already late in the afternoon, and to miss the road meant wandering all night on these frozen summits. The disproportion between a giant glacier range, that wild and endless slope, and the two puny travelers who had ventured alone in that extraordinarily phantasmagoric land of the heights impressed me as it had never done before. And then an inexpressible feeling of compassion moved me to the bottom of my heart. It could not be possible that my young friend, the companion of so many of my travels, should meet his end on that mountain. I would find the way. It was my duty.
But it was not until 2 o'clock in the morning that they managed to identify the path that would lead them out of this white wilderness. As they stumbled up over the summit, which Alexandra calculated to be 19,000 feet high, and down towards the snow line, they gave thanks to the providence which had prompted them to make a good breakfast. By now they had been climbing, scrambling, and floundering through the snow for 19 hours without stopping or refreshing themselves in any way. Even now they could not risk ceasing until they had found the wherewithal to make a fire. Without the heat of a fire, their bodies would soon succumb to the cold. The only fuel they could find was some old yak dung, a few damp twigs, and a little moss scraped from the rocks. Yet the previous day's snowfall had left even this meager supply too damp to ignite.
At the Kumbu Monastery, I had studied tumoreskyang, the strange art of increasing the internal heat. Eventually I had become proficient enough to spend 5 months of the cold season wearing a single cotton garment at 13,000 feet. But the present was not the time to look selfishly after my own comfort. I wanted to try and kindle a fire that would warm Yongden as well as myself. I put the flint and steel and a pinch of moss under my clothes, sat down and began to practice. I began to doze, yet my mind continued to be concentrated on the object of the tumo rite. Soon I saw flames rising around me. They grew higher and higher. They enveloped me, curling their tongues above my head. I felt deliciously comfortable. A loud noise awakened me. The ice on the river was rending. The flames suddenly died down as if entering the ground. I opened my eyes. My body burned. I was still half dreaming, although I had got up and walked towards the tent. I felt fire bursting out of my head, of my fingers. I placed on the ground a little grass, a small piece of dung, and I struck the stone. A spark rang out of it. And another. The fire was lighted.
Alexandra's relation of episodes like this was inevitably fodder to the skeptics. To their criticism, Alexandra would only reply that she did not care whether or not they believed in such phenomena and had no desire to convince them. Whether the heat she generated was real or imaginary was irrelevant. All that was certain was that the exercise of her mystic powers had enabled her on more than one occasion to survive under conditions that would otherwise have been intolerable. Certainly, the rigors of the journey were having a dramatic effect on her mental as well as her physical state. Photographs taken 2 years before, during her stay at the Kumbum Monastery, show a short, sturdy lady with a round face and an ample bosom. One would guess her to be a suburban schoolmistress, maybe, or patronne of a respectable Parisian café bar. Months of punishing physical effort at consistently high altitudes had changed all that. The wizened, weather-beaten little figure tramping resolutely across the Tibetan heights was spider-thin. The effects of hunger and fatigue were intensifying her tendency to seek out and then abandon herself to the mystical element in every experience. Lack of proper nourishment and the rarity of the atmosphere had brought her to a level of heightened awareness bordering on the hallucinatory.
Towards the evening of the next day, we reached the end of the valley that led down from the pass and entered another, wider valley enclosed between high ranges. No trace of human being was to be seen. The country was truly what the Tibetans call the empty land. The sun shone, although clouds wandered to and fro in a sky of a lighter blue than it had previously been. That immense space in which we were the only living beings, as if we had been the first inhabitants and masters of the earth, was extremely pleasant to the eye, and the emptiness had a very peculiar charm.
So pervasive was this sense of solitude, so vast their relief at having successfully negotiated the Virgin Pass, that they were content just to look and to breathe and to walk. Neither of them appeared aware of the implications of the emptiness of the valley. The hamlet was nowhere to be seen, and the shepherds and their flocks had long since departed for the winter. Even the shrine seemed to have disappeared.
By mid-morning, the snow was falling, lightly at first, just a few butterflies whirling against the black rocks. Then it gradually became more and more dense, one of those slow snowfalls whose flakes descend from some inexhaustible heavenly store, shrouding the mighty peaks and burying the valleys. Soon it was so thick that we had no hope of fixing a shelter, for we would have been buried before long. So, no rest being possible, it was better to walk and keep warm. We tramped the remainder of the day and all through the night without making much progress. The soft snow made walking difficult.
For 3 days and nights, it snowed. Instead of heading back down into an inhabited valley, they found themselves climbing again towards another huge snow-covered mass of mountain. Well, they finished the last of their food, forcing themselves on, crossing yet another pass through drifts that threatened to overwhelm them. But Alexandra laughed at their struggles and shook her bony fists at the elements. When Yung Den slipped and fell into a shallow crevasse, severely spraining his ankle, she airily announced that she was going to carry him down the mountain.
But in spite of my goodwill and strenuous efforts, I was soon compelled to realize that I lacked the strength necessary to carry him across deep snow. Yung Den, who had reluctantly obeyed my command to let himself be carried, then endeavored to proceed, leaning on me and on his staff, creeping rather than walking and stopping every 10 minutes. Yet, had it not been for my concern for my young companion, I should have found a peculiar charm in my situation. Indeed, that charm was so powerful that it triumphed over my preoccupations and my physical discomfort. Late into the night, I remained motionless, enjoying the delights of my solitude in the absolute silence, the perfect stillness of the strange white land, sunk in unshaken rapture, in utter peace.
By the time they reached the foot of the pass, Yung Den was barely conscious. Alexandra's boots had worn out, and they had survived for 72 hours on a diet of melted snow. One more night without a fire or any hot food would almost certainly kill them. Mercifully, just as darkness was falling, they sighted a village. When they knocked on the door of the first house, the owner gasped in amazement. Where had they come from? The passes had been closed by snow for a week. It was really a wonder. They must be holy indeed to have achieved such a miracle. In the land Alexandra had been led to believe was peopled by thieves and brigands, they suddenly found every door open to them, and every householder anxious to gain merit by entertaining two such venerable beings.
We were invited to sit down and produce our bowls, which were filled with hot soup. Was it good? Was it bad? I could not say. I only felt the inner animal joy of the starving man at his first contact with food after a long fast. It seemed to me that beings rushed up from the depth of my body towards my mouth to feed upon the thick mixture of barley, water, curd, and turnips that I swallowed eagerly.
Although they were still 300 miles from Lhasa, Alexandra felt that their survival was a good omen. But Yung Den warned her against undue optimism. Yet, you see, her spirits would not be suppressed. The route was easy, the countryside breathtakingly beautiful, and their goal, if not actually in sight, at least within reach. Ignoring her companion's warnings, she chatted freely to pilgrim and villager alike. She took detours off the path to explore tempting byways, and felt bold enough to venture the odd prophecy, blessing, or even curse when the moment arose.
We tarried long in that beautiful region, walking leisurely during the day and sleeping generally in the open, at the foot of a tree or in a cave when lucky enough to discover one.
The one remaining barrier that lay between them and Lhasa was the toll station at Giamda, a small town on an upper tributary of the Brahmaputra River. Here, they would have to appear before an official in order to get a pass to proceed to the capital. As they approached the town, they spent several sleepless nights trying to devise a strategy for getting through undetected.
I resolved that even if I came face to face with the official, I would stand fast. Not for one moment did I consider the idea of failure. I had sworn that a woman would pass, and I would. We crossed the bridge, paid the toll, and were led by a boy to an official's house. I sent Yung Den in and sat down in the dust by the doorstep. Many people passed through the narrow street and no one took any notice of me. And I waited and waited.
At long last, Yung Den reappeared, a great smile on his face, and they took up their load. The dreaded Giamda was behind them. Now it was Yung Den's turn to relax. The road grew busier every day, with pilgrims from every part of Tibet hurrying towards Lhasa for the New Year festival. Amongst so many, who would notice two more? But Alexandra was scarcely aware of any of them. Her eyes were fixed on the horizon ahead. She walked like one in a trance, unaware of the scenery, oblivious to the cold, every nerve tingling. Once again, she gives no dates, but as the Tibetans use the Chinese calendar and the Chinese New Year falls in February, this meant that they had been walking for 4 months. Now, the end was in sight.
A miracle seemed to protect our entrance into Lhasa. The weather was clear, dry and cold, the sky luminous. In the rosy light of the morning sun, we sighted the Patala, the huge palace of the Dalai Lama, majestic and impressive. Yet no sooner had we set eyes on it than all of a sudden a furious storm arose, lifting clouds of dust into the sky. Indistinct forms passed us, men bent in two, hiding their faces in the laps of their dresses. An immense yellow curtain of whirling sand was spread before the Patala, blinding its guests, hiding from them Lhasa, the roads leading to it, and those who walked upon them. Who could see us coming? Who could know us?
The storm abated as suddenly as it had arisen. Newcomers, unacquainted with the city, bewildered by the noise and the crowds after months in the solitudes, and perhaps still more bewildered by their good luck, they stood at a loss, not knowing where to go. Unexpected help came in the shape of a young woman moved to compassion by Alexandra's gaunt appearance. She led them to an old, crumbling house, occupied by other beggars, and they were given the use of a narrow cell. It was perfect. Nobody would ever think of looking for a foreigner in such a decrepit and unsavory corner of the city.
In our hovel that evening, lying on the ground amongst our miserable luggage, I said to my faithful companion, "Do you allow me now to say that we have won the game?" "Yes," he said. "We are at Lhasa." Although I had endeavored to reach the Tibetan capital, rather because I had been challenged than out of any real desire to visit it, now that I stood on forbidden ground at the cost of so much hardship and danger, I meant to enjoy myself in all possible ways. All sights, all things which are Lasse's own beauty and peculiarity would have to be seen by the lone woman explorer who had come to them from afar, the first of her sex. It would be my well-won reward after the trials of the road, and I intended that nobody should deprive me of it.
Almost before they'd had time to draw breath, Alexandra was whirling Jungden round the sights of Lhasa. First, and most important of all, they made a tour of the Potala Palace, where a yellow-robed lama made her heart miss a beat by telling her to remove her headdress. Luckily, in the gloom of the narrow passages, illuminated only by flickering butter lamps, no one noticed anything strange. They explored bazaars and visited shrines. They followed religious processions through the steep, twisting streets and joined the crowds of pilgrims in a tour of the lamaseries to celebrate the new year.
And oh, how I loved the merrymaking. The final festival was attended by no less a person than the Dalai Lama himself, and all Lhasa was in the crowd. Groups of sturdy giants, cowmen clad in sheepskin, ran for joy in the deepest of the throng, their big fists belaboring the ribs of those in their way. Bands were playing, women were screaming. There were clergy, nobility, and traders all thronging together, laughing, all more or less drunk and happy. Their gaiety was contagious. Jungden and I went with the crowd, running, jostling, and pushing like everyone else, enjoying, as youngsters might have done, the fun of being in Lhasa for the new year. Policemen armed with long sticks and whips, growing ever more excited as the time of the Dalai Lama's coming approached, used their weapons indiscriminately, and one hit me with a truncheon because I'd strayed into the path of a nobleman. Truly, I had to make a great effort to prevent myself from giving him a tip. So delighted was I with the fun. What a wonderful incognito is mine, I confided to Jungden. Now I'm even beaten in the street. After that, I felt completely secure.
Alexandra and Jungden stayed in Lhasa for 2 months. Then rumors started to circulate that a foreigner had been seen in the city, and she knew that it was time to go. She claimed still to be in rude health, but privately acknowledged that in reality she was little more than skin and bone. If she was to have the strength to make the journey home, she had better leave now.
So, one sunny morning in spring, I followed once more the wide street that led out of the city, leaving Lhasa as quietly as I had entered. We crossed the river and ascended a small pass. I looked back for one last time, and then, turning to the south, began my descent. Lhasa had forever gone from my eyes and taken its place in the world of memories.
By August, Alexandra was back in Sikkim, having taken the direct route south from Lhasa to British India. A year later, she returned to her native France. Her journey and the book she wrote made her a celebrity. The controversy over the more mystical passages only added to her fame. She was awarded the gold medal of the Geographical Society of France and made a Chevalier of the Legion of Honor. She returned to Asia in 1936 and stayed for a further 8 years, before finally retiring to a small cottage in the French Alps. She died in 1969, just a few weeks before her 101st birthday.
An Unforgettable Vision, the story of Alexandra David Neal, was written and compiled by Julia Kay. Dorothy Chutin played Alexandra, and Daniel Massey was the narrator. The producer was John Powell.